Les colloques du Collège de France.
So we have now an afternoon session dedicated to ferroptosis, and without any further ado, I invite Markus Konrad from the Technical University of Munich, who will tell us about ferroptosis modulation for disease prevention.
All right, yeah. Thank you, Hugues, for this wonderful invitation to come to Paris. I never say no when I get invitation to get here, for some other reasons as well, so to meet some friends and collaborators and have some nice oysters and champagne, etc. So that's what we always do, right? Besides a little bit of science. Okay, yeah, so welcome, and I'm happy to open the ferroptosis session. As you'll see from my talk, we have been there for a long, long time. So some of you know my talks, so if you're getting bored, yeah, just do your emails and so on. It's fine for me, I know that. But anyway, so I will talk a little bit, go back, and also this morning, we heard already a little introduction already by Guido on the different forms of cell death which have been discovered since the first form of cell death, which is apoptosis, was coined in 1972 by this very famous paper. Of course, the landscape has changed dramatically right now. We know it's not only apoptosis and necrosis, so you can also subdivide necrosis in different forms of cell death. This was to summarize an older review we wrote together, summarizing at least some of the forms which we still think, as of today, that they're really relevant. So of course, on one hand, you have apoptosis, different forms of apoptosis, inflammatory forms of cell death, netosis, which is eating of a cell, and so on, was brought up by Mike Overholzer a couple of years ago. There's pathognathosis, pyroptosis, and finally, that's what we're talking today about, is ferroptosis. There was a seminal work published by Brent Stockwell in 2012. He coined this term of cell death. He has been working on for, I think, around 10 years or so as iron-dependent form of cell death ferroptosis. But as you see from my work, I didn't know Brent until 2013, so we were working really parallel in Munich on a novel form of cell death, which we didn't understand. And this was based on work of my mentor, Georg Bornkamm, who was the first PhD student of Zuhausen, who got a Nobel Prize for HPV quite some years back. And he was studying the growth behavior of Burkitt lymphoma cells, which is the fastest growing tumor in humans. It's a c-MYC-driven tumor, and they have a very peculiar phenotype. They grow very rapidly, so you have to split them maybe every 2 or 3 days. But you have to be very careful. They're very sensitive. So if you split them too strongly, they would die very rapidly overnight in 12 hours or so. And the concentration, it's something like you talk about 500,000 cells per milliliter. So they're very sensitive. Of course, he tried to understand the mechanism, what's behind these things. And he discovered that basically when you add copper chelators or nanomolar concentration of sodium selenite, the trace element, or beta-mercaptoethanol, any thiol-containing antioxidant, you could rescue this phenotype. Now you could basically culture these cells at 1 cell per milliliter. There was a very strong rescue. And he was actually also taking this system to look for genes which can protect these cells from dying at low cell density. And one of the genes he was really chasing for was XCT. We heard a nice talk this morning by Raphael on SLC711, XCT, there are many different names, system XC minus and so on. And actually, he was looking for that gene. The identity of the gene was unknown at the time. The activity was known as a cystine glutamate antiporter. Actually, he failed, so he didn't clone it. It was eventually cloned by a Japanese group, by Hideo Sato and Shirobana in 1999. Instead, he found another gene, GPX4. At the time, it had a different name. It was called phospholipid hydroperoxide glutathione peroxidase, PHGPX. The enzyme was already known. It was cloned by a group in Padua by Fulvio Zini. He cloned the gene as a second glutathione peroxidase. Now there are 8 glutathione peroxidase. This is now called number 4, so GPX4. And actually, I'm very proud of this paper because this is my first paper of my career. And you see, authorship right in the middle, as you would wish, right? Published in a journal, Biofactors. No one knows that paper or journal. And no one, and it's almost never cited. And Imperfecta at that time was below 2 or so. So that's what the start of my career. Still, it was my first paper. I continued along these lines. So I made knockouts. This was my duty as a PhD student. And we did, you see from the years, it took 10 years or so to understand what's going on, at least to get it published. So made a knockout, and it was very surprising what we found. Actually, first we found when you knock out the genes in cells and fibroblasts, the cells, they die. They die quite rapidly, around 2 to 3 days upon knockout induction. I'll show you a movie in a minute. And it was not clear how they die. So we did, of course, we used inhibitors against different forms of cell death. We couldn't prevent, so it was clear it's something new. We also knew it's very important. So when you knock out the gene in neurons, you get neurodegeneration early on, right after birth. So these mice have severe seizures, neurodegeneration, and so forth. So we knew already something was very important. We also dig more into the mechanism. And initially, we thought there's some lipoxygenase might be involved in this pathway, because this was purely based on inhibitors, which later turned out to be radical traps. Because we made the genetics double knocker, there was no rescue at all. So basically, we could wipe that out. Another gene which we thought would be important was actually cloned here in Paris. So IFM1, apoptosin-inducing factor mitochondria-associated 1, AIF1, different names. We also thought in the beginning this was based on guide RNAs. It later turned out to be that these guide RNAs were not very specific. So also that, by doing CRISPR now knockouts, we could also wipe this out. You see, not much left, right, of the title of the paper. But nonetheless, GPX4 is very important, as we know, and this is perhaps the key regulator of this form of cell death. What is GPX4? Sorry, I have to go a little bit into the biochemical mechanisms. It's one out of 25 solenoid proteins in man. That's very unique. It contains, instead of cysteine, which is shown here, a sulfur group, contains selenium cysteine in its active site. That's quite unique how to use it. And what is selenium? It's a trace element I mentioned before. And this was discovered already in 1817 by a Swedish scientist, a chemist close to Stockholm in Kripsholm, a very small-like church. And he found a selenium at the time. He named it after goddess of the moon, selenium. That's why this little picture in the beginning of the moon is symbolizing in my first slide. That's a function of GPX4. It's a very powerful enzyme. It's actually so far almost the only enzyme which can very effectively reduce peroxides in phospholipid bilayer, so PLOOH, by reducing directly to alcohol OH. And of course, the enzyme becomes oxidized. You lose two electrons. You need to feed in again two electrons by glutathione. One makes you make this selenium disulfide mixed group. And then this needs to be resolved by a second glutathione. You end up in the reduced form. The enzyme is super, super fast. It's a very powerful enzyme, you will see later. And that's why we're also very much interested in working on this. But why is GPX4 a selenoprotein protein in man? Actually, in all vertebrates. GPX4 is present in all organisms, basic to some degree, bacteria, yeast, etc., plants. But usually it's a cysteine-containing enzyme. And of course, we were also interested in this, and it's because it's very complicated to make a selenoprotein. Because not only making the tRNA loaded with a selenocysteine is very complicated, but also incorporation of selenocysteine into the polynasal chain is complex, as you see in the next movie, not movie, next sketch. So first, for the first step, you have a specific tRNA. This one first needs to be loaded with a serine. The serine needs to be phosphorylated by a kinase. And this needs to be converted into selenocysteine. You see already that you need lots of proteins to convert, to load it, selenocysteine tRNA loaded. And so you need already several factors. In addition, since selenocysteine is encoded by the UGA codon, it's one of the three stop codons, you also have to tell the ribosomes, don't stop here. This is a selenocysteine coding protein. For this, you need several factors which actually bind to this so-called cesis element, which is a stem loop-like structure. It's like a landing platform for many different proteins. And that's together in concert, they will tell the ribosome, don't stop at the stop, incorporate selenocysteine. But this is a very inefficient process. If you compare this with a normal amino acid like alanine, cysteine, serine, whatever, it ranks between 1 and 5% of efficiency. So you see, why do we have GPX4 as a selenoprotein? And we did some studies, and I don't have time to go into all these details. I just need to remind you, because this is very important, because it's a very important factor how cells become sensitive to fructose, as we'll see later in my last part of the talk. I promised I will show you a little movie, so how these cells die when we knock out GPX4. This was very unique, a good model. People now use it very extensively, so we have inducible knockout where we can now genetically inactivate GPX4 in cell culture. What we did at the time, we isolated fibroblasts from the mice, we stable transfected them with inducible Cre recombinase, you add tamoxifen to the cell culture, you liberate Cre. It goes inside the nucleus, destroys the gene, you get a functional knockout. At the time, there were no inhibitors against GPX4. So we used that model quite extensively. And that's actually shown here in this little movie. So these are two cells which have been treated with tamoxifen for around 1 to 2 days. And then it takes a while to develop the phenotype. In the beginning, you see everything is fine. They're very happy, kissing, hugging, all good, as always in life, right? But it sometimes happens in life, you get a little bit angry. You're not so well anymore. At some point, you separate. And then, of course, eventually you die. And that's what's happening. You see, just taking out GPX4, this huge bubbling up, and the cells are dead. We use that model quite extensively for pharmacological screens. We use it for genetic screens. No time, it's all published. We used a screening, which I think was quite, at the time, there was no ferroptosis out there. We started screening in 2011. We found around 400 molecules out of 40,000 drug-like compounds we screened. They're all new compounds. And one of the molecules which we have been using quite extensively is so-called lipoxatin, it's spironolactone by its chemical nature. And this was also the basis for further development. This is going to be hopefully finished, this preclinical development, end of this year, so that we can enter clinical trials and liver transplantation next year. We also were fortunate enough to bring this molecule very effectively across the blood-brain barrier. So basically inject into the mouse in the belly or IV, and within 20 minutes to half an hour, everything is soaked up in the brain. We don't know the mechanism. We know the modification, but we know how that works so effectively. Hopefully, we can use these molecules later to treat certain types of neurodegenerative disease conditions. But as Steve Jobs used to say, there's one more thing. There was one more thing in this little crappy paper published in 2001. Because besides GPX4, you see here, PHGPX and so on, I found another gene. I called it putative NADH oxidase. We did not much do work on this. We made a knockout mouse at the time already. There was no phenotype. We worked on the enzyme a little bit, no phenotype. We thought after 2 or 3 years, we got very bored. We said, stop this. No, it doesn't lead anywhere. So we stopped it. We froze the mice. We froze the cells. And everything was gone. And we thought, forgot about it, actually. Almost. But we were sitting maybe on something very important, which turned out to be later the case. This is the original box, my box, for my PhD, you see here. This is the clone which I found in 2000, you see, 1999. So basically it's now, what is now? It's 25, 26 years almost. So anyway, so it was sitting there for a long time. So we repeated the screen. We did a genetic suppressor screen a few years ago. And a very robust screen, no time to go into the details, but very robust. We use the genetics and also some inhibitors now against GPX4, which is RSL3 developed by Brand's lab. And we found another gene besides GPX4, an enzyme which we called FSP1, fructose suppressor protein 1. That gene we just renamed, it's a fake name. It had a different name. Meanwhile, it was annotated as apoptosis-inducing factor mitochondria-associated 2, named after IFM1, because there are some structural similarities. Anyway, we thought that it doesn't play any role in apoptosis. We should rename it. Otherwise, you always have to write in each abstract you're submitting, grant, no, it does not play a role in apoptosis. It's a fructose regulator. Okay, so let's change the name. And this is actually the enzyme we were sitting on for almost 20 years or so without knowing it. So this was actually the real story. When you overexpress the enzyme, it's very funny. So the cells become super resistant. So these are mock transfected cells, these overexpressing cells. You treat them with RSL3, they would die within half a day or so. You see to the left, to the right, they survive. You can knock out GPX4, they survive forever in the absence of GPX4. You can keep them, as I said, forever. We looked into the mechanism for a long time. We found that what it does, the enzyme, it reduces so-called extra mitochondrial ubiquinone. Because in cells, as you learn in school, when you get your biochemistry courses, you always learn there's a lot of ubiquinone inside of mitochondria. It's very important for the electron transport chain to shuttle electrons from complex 2 to 3. But there's also quite substantial amounts of ubiquinone outside of mitochondria. That's why it's called ubiquinone everywhere. In some cells, even 50% of all ubiquinone is outside of mitochondria. But it was not really clear for a long time how this is being reduced, and actually the missing role or missing enzyme which does that job very effectively is FSP1, and explains why seven cells have this huge amount of extra mitochondrial ubiquinone, because FSP1 is reducing it and protecting cells from ferroptosis. It's not the only one. We also found when Aika Mishima, a very talented scientist, came to my lab just right after the first lockdown in 2020, he had made an observation back in Japan where he found that vitamin K, so K stands for, it's a German word at the time, there were a lot of German words, coagulation, important for blood clotting. He found that even vitamin K can also be very powerful in protecting from ferroptosis. This is just now shown for vitamin K2, there are different forms, K1, K2, K3. K1 is the one which is highly enriched in greeny leaves and spinach. So it's very good for health. Vitamin K2 is highly enriched, also produced by bacteria. So if you like Japanese food, fermented Japanese food, It's very enriched in this, so it's the highest amount of vitamin K. But nonetheless, all the stories, you see that when you knock out or when you treat cells with the ferroptosis-induced RSL3, you can nicely prevent this kind of dying by adding increasing concentrations of vitamin K. And just shown here, there's a fibrosarcoma cell line treated with RSL3. When you have no vitamin K2, the disease cells, they explode, they get big and round up. Whereas when you treat them with MK4, which is vitamin K2, you see the cells are very happy, they're dividing, you see chromosomes dividing here, and so on. You see the cells are super happy. So it's a very powerful anti-ferroptotic agent. Of course, also always concentration. Usually in body is not so much, but some tissues contain quite large amounts. Which led us to propose this little cycle we call a non-canonical Mishima cycle, because of course vitamin K is very important for blood clotting, very essential for blood clotting, for bone metabolism, many other things. But of course there's now this little cycle. We propose a smaller cycle, which then basically helps to protect membranes from radical damage by reducing these peroxyl radicals to a peroxide, and thereby preventing lipid oxidation chain reaction and ferroptosis. Of course, another finding of the story was that there was another enzyme which was missing for a long, long time, which was postulated more than 50 years ago. So all the genes were cloned, but one enzyme was missing, the so-called warfarin-resistant vitamin K reductase. Because usually when you take warfarin or decumarol as a blood thinner, it usually counteracts all these vitamin K epoxide reductase. But one enzyme which was missing, which is the so-called warfarin-resistant enzyme, we also found in this paper, that is FSP1. The picture has changed a lot. There's a huge hype of papers coming out. And it's just summarizing the most important pathway. We heard this morning already, the cysteine glutamate antiporter system, which feeds glutathione synthesis and GPX4. Of course, we have FSP1 with different cofactors. On the other hand, which is a very strong backup system for GPX4, there's also the bioptrin pathway, which is shown here, and also some intermediates of the cholesterol pathway can also act as anti-ferroptotic agents, whereas on the other hand, enriching membranes with PUFAs, polyunsaturated fatty acids, sensitizes tumor cells in general to ferroptose, because these are the proximate targets of peroxides in membranes. I just took this picture. It's very important, I think, because we just published it a few weeks ago. I just want to be too bold here. But I think for the newcomers in the field, I think it's very advisable to read that little thing, because we make a very easy summary and we discuss this with editors and said we need to have it now, because so many people are entering the field. They don't know all the complexities of redox biology, iron biology, lipid metabolism, and so forth, and antibody problems and mouse models, cell models, et cetera, et cetera. So if you want to really go into it, I think it's quite useful and helpful, which also for your students not to dip into all these problems, which we did last 20 years or so. Coming now to cancer, of course, there's been a big hype. Many groups have published already that certain types of cancer cells basically become sensitive, vulnerable to ferroptosis, especially those undergoing epithelial-mesenchymal transition or metastasis, and also those being surviving chemotherapy, which are called persister cells. And there was work done by Schreiber's lab, by Hanger's lab, by Sean Morrison's lab, and people from Erlangen, from Thomas Prabletz, and also from Yilong Zhao quite recently, where they all showed how this basic impacts on ferroptosis. And we knew already from a long time ago that when we stained for FSP1 expression, we found that FSP1 is expressed in quite a variety of cancer cell lines, especially lung cancer, to some extent in brain cancer and liver cancer and kidney cancer. So what we did, we developed a new inhibitor against the enzyme, because the one which we published already in 2019 is one which works, but it doesn't work in vivo. So we need an in vivo active compound. So we did another screening and we found this phenylkinasolinones as a molecule which can nicely induce ferroptosis, as shown here, in cells which are knocked out for GPX4 expressing the human FSP1. You can nicely induce cell death in these cells. We looked into the mechanism of the thing. We found quite early that it behaves quite a bit weird. So that was puzzled us for a while. So if you compare IC-FSP1, with the new one, with the old one, IFSP1, in vitro assays, we saw a very big difference between both inhibitors when inhibiting FSP1, whereas when we looked into cell culture, there was no difference. So it was very clear there must be something very unique. Maybe it becomes activated, we thought about, or something, sub-cell localization, et cetera, et cetera. So we looked into it and we generated cell lines where we basically GFP-tagged or BFP-tagged FSP1, treated the cells, and what you see here now is basically when you treat the cells with this inhibitor, you can nicely see this strong dot formation. And of course, we looked into the dots and thought first it's localizing somewhere, lysosomes, you heard this morning, ER or other places, but we could not find any co-localization. We also knew when we wash out the compound from these cells, treated cells, so these are now treated, so you see all these dots. Now you wash it out after a while, and all of a sudden you see they basically disappear again. So it was very clear it was a reversal process. And of course, this is all published, so you can to read all the details. I don't have the time to go into all the details. We then eventually figured out that these condensates are actuated, regulated by phase separation, and a concept which I think is very interesting because the enzyme itself contains all the structural elements which are important to make this phase separation. We still don't know why it has it. So what's the physiological role of having this? There must be something that we were looking into, but we still don't understand why. At least in the context of this compound, it induces phase separation. We also looked into in vivo, this was the original plan, to have a molecule which can at least inject into mice, which are stable enough. And you see here as a comparison to FSP1 here, this is much better. It's not great yet. Half-life is around 6 hours or so. You have to do a bi-daily treatment. It's not so nice for the students because they have to come in the morning, in the evening, on a Saturday and a Sunday and so on. So it's a lot of treatment necessary if you don't have a pump. And that's what we did. We used cell lines where we knocked out endogenous GPX4, it's a B6 and F10 cell line. We also knocked out endogenous FSP1 mouse and re-expressed human FSP1 because the molecule is specific for the human, unfortunately. So it only inhibits human isoform. But still, of course, if you want to treat patients, better than the mouse, okay, in this context. But you see also here when we treat them, the tumor-bearing mice, it's not great yet, of course, I agree, but still we see some kind of protection already, at least in this model. And if you can be patient, there will be several papers coming out quite soon on this molecule in a very as a single treatment that looks very, very exciting, but it's not my work, I cannot talk about it. Sorry, it takes maybe a few more months or so, but it looks very exciting. So skip that one. This is the summary. So basically we have FSP1, which is lipidated, it sticks to the membrane. Once it sees ICFSP1, it will bind to it somehow in this context of this myostylation tag. It also requires a very important amino acid residue, glutamine 319. Then it uses phase separation, this kind of dots. The enzyme is inactive, the cells will die. And we also, as I mentioned before, FSP1 is a human-specific inhibitor. So I had a PhD student, a super talented PhD student for a while in my lab. And he was, of course, also interested in the molecule. And he found that basically, and he was comparing human and mouse enzyme, there are only around 30 differences. So what he did, this was a Japanese way, sorry. So he did, he changed all the ones being there present, the differences in human and mouse and made double mutations. And he found that when he mutates one of the amino acids, he gets resistance. So he actually pinpointed exactly which is the amino acid binding to IFSP1. So this was a very nice undertaking. He went on because we need a mouse specific, or at least one which also recognizes not only human, but also mouse. We did another screening of around 10,000 compounds, I think, in this context. We found one of these molecules, which we call versatile inhibitor of FSP1, because it inhibits not only mouse, but also mouse, human, rat, and frog, it's very funny, because usually they have problems. But anyway, it's very funny, and the molecule works quite well. You can induce ferroptosis, and you can inhibit the enzymes. Also, when you treat the cells, you can also induce lipoxidation, as shown here. When you treat them with VIFSP1, you can prevent by lipoxstatin co-treatment, so this to the right is lipoxidation, and it's very similar to also in mouse versus human. You see there's almost no difference. It's a very powerful molecule. He also did some further studies to show, to find the binding mechanism. At the time, there was no structure published, just an alpha fold, and so basically of FSP1, and so he did a PCR probe mutagenesis assay to find out all the different sites in the enzyme, which are important for a binding to the molecule. And by doing so, by deep sequencing, he could identify several amino acids, which makes the enzyme more sensitive or, more importantly, resistant to treatment with VIFSP1, so which then allowed him to show that the enzyme actually, or the molecule, binds here in this very big pocket. It's a very big promiscuous pocket in FSP1, which accommodates many cofactors like FAD, NADPH, and so forth, and its substrates. Which brings us summary here until here. So IFSP1, we now identify the binding site, the Kinon binding site, while VIFSP1 and NADH binding pockets. So it is basic, but in principle, they work very, very similarly. Unfortunately, or yeah, that's a bit the downside, the enzyme is not yet, the molecule is not yet stable enough to be used in vivo. So we cannot use it yet. We have to make it more stable, and we are working on this. But then there was always a big question. I mentioned in the beginning, GPX4 is the only enzyme which is very powerful in reducing peroxides directly, unlike FSP1, which does on the level of radicals. And so we're scratching our head on this for a long, long time. We're still asking, are there any other systems? And we found something very exciting, at least it was work by Junya Ito back in Tokyo University before I came to my lab. He made an interesting observation. He used, he established a new screening or a new enzyme assay where you can now measure the remaining amount of peroxides in lysates and in lysates of cells, and he checked in wild type. He also checked in knockout cells, and you still see there's a substantial reduction of this phosphatidylcholine hydroperoxides in the cells, which is definitely not coming from GPX4 because we knocked it out. So there's still a very substantial reduction or reductive capacity in these cells, and so we ask. What could it be? Where does it come from? It's certainly not FSP1 because the mechanism is totally different, chemically speaking. There's one enzyme which is known as phosphatidylcholine non-selenium glutathione peroxidase, which is now known as peroxyredoxin 6. It's one out of six peroxyredoxins, and this is they form these dimers, homodimers, and there's three distinct sites. So there's serine 32, which is a phospholipase A2 activity. Shown here, there's a cysteine 47, which is so-called peroxidase activity, and C91, which is an alternative cysteine residue. People don't even understand exactly what it does. So we ask, could it be a backup system in our GPX4 knockout cells? Because the enzyme does a very similar role than, or has been reported to do a very similar function like GPX4, but instead of using selenocysteine, it uses cysteine in its active site, and also glutathione as a cofactor. So we overexpressed the enzyme in our cells, in GPX4 knockout cells. When we induce a knockout, you see the cells that die, as you saw in the movie. When you now overexpress FSP1 or GTP cyclohydrolase, which is important for making biopterin, you get a very strong protection against ferroptosis, whereas when you overexpress PRDX6, no rescue. So it was very clear it doesn't do the job. So there's no protective activity. So we looked more into the details, and what we found was very exciting, because then started to become exciting, because when we knocked down PRDX6, we found that GPX4 also goes away. So this was very anything else than expected. And so we became very much interested. We also checked in different cancer cell lines where there's a similar behavior. Now we took all these different sorts of cancer cell lines, renal cell and so on, lung cancer, etc. Whenever we knock out or knock down PRDX6, you see GPX4 is gone, mostly gone, or at least strongly, strongly reduced. So this was kind of something which intrigued us. We also checked, of course, all the other family members, so 1, 2, 5. So we knocked out all of them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you see there's no change in GPX4 expression, indicating something very unique to PRDX6. When we use these cell lines, as shown here, sorry, it's a bit busy, but just as an example. So when we knocked out, so these are wild type, these are knockout cell lines in green. And you see when we now make a knockout of PRDX6 and treat them with different ferroptosis inducers like RSL3, ML210, FIN56, etc., racemate at morning, sulfasalazine, and so on, you always get a nice sensitization towards ferroptosis. Also, when we take IFSP1, VIFSP1, and ICFSP1 inhibitors against FSP1, you also get a very strong sensitization towards a ferroptosis. When we took away the remaining bit of selenium from the medium in this cell culture, in this PRDX6 knockout cells, these are fibrosarcoma cell lines being knocked out. You see, wild type, they survive, they do quite well, but when you knock out PRDX6, again, they die by ferroptosis very rapidly due to loss of GPX4. We looked even more into the details. We mutated all these different sites, like cysteine 47, serine 32, and cysteine 91, and we found when we only touch cysteine 47, we don't get any recovery of GPX4, indicating it's a cysteine 47 in PRDX6, which is important to make GPX4 and other selenoproteins. Also, when you then treat these cells, they become only those which are expressing the mutant form, they are not resistant, they cannot resist our cell-free treatment in these cells. We did many, many more studies. So actually, I don't have time to go into all the biochemical mechanisms. We found eventually that that's a real mechanism now. So what we think is that PRDX6 is a carrier or shuttles selenium from the lysosome, likely from the lysosome, to an enzyme which is called selenophosphate synthetase, which synthesizes the second last step in the tRNA synthesis. That's why I showed the cartoon at the very beginning. And that's basically, that's why a very important function for PRDX6, it shuttles the selenium or hydrogen selenide, which is bound to the cysteine 47 to CEPHS2. And then this is used for making tRNA, which ultimately is important for generating GPX4 and other selenoproteins. To show whether this has any role in vivo, so we knocked out PRDX6 and transplanted these knockout cell lines into mice, and you can nicely see that just knocking out PRDX alone has an impact on tumor growth. And when you now co-treat these tumor-bearing mice with IKE, which is a stabilized Erastin, so a systemic C-minus inhibitor, you can further decrease the tumor size. So it could well be that PRDX6 might be a target for new inhibitors, which are people, I think, following up now. With this, I come to the end. Of course, I didn't have time to talk anything about the other side of the coin, which is basically ferroptosis inhibition, where we hopefully can generate inhibitors and tools to prevent certain types of disease conditions, where we now firmly or very strongly convinced that ferroptosis plays a very important role in these forms of diseases, such as ischemia perfusion injuries, like in ischemic stroke, organ transplantation, intestinal IRI, or also certain types of neurodegenerative disease. We have some very strong evidence that ferroptosis plays an important role in Alzheimer's disease and ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Whereas on the other hand, of course, using inhibitors for activating ferroptosis, of course, would be the preferred thing to treat certain types of cancers. I mentioned not only to inhibit tumor growth, but also metastasis, which I think is now quite strongly worked out in the field of metastasis. So all the groups are actually working on ferroptosis, I heard. And of course, also in so-called standard therapy resistant cancers, either as a standalone or in combination with checkpoint inhibitors. With this, I come to the important slides to all my group. Of course, I have to mention Aika Mishima. He's here. He's an amazing scientist. He will go back next year. Toshitaka Nakamura, he was an amazing student, PhD student in my lab. He went back to industry for a little while. I was very disappointed. He did the same way as I did. But also he stepped out again. It took him only a couple of months to realize not his business. So he left and now he teamed up with Kivan Sprozoi's lab at Rockefeller University. The good news is he's back in academia. The bad news is he goes to an already strong lab. So, Kivan is a friend of mine. That's okay. And Bettina, yeah, she's my right hand. She's doing all the drug development. Junior Ito, a visiting scientist, always smiling. That's him. Yeah, it's here. And Sebastian Doll, he did a lot of work on FSP1. And many people in my lab working also on neurodegeneration, other diseases. We have many collaborators on campus, also worldwide, of course, and also all the funding opportunities. And with this, if you're interested in ferroptosis, we're back. Not back, but we're back in Japan. So next year we have another Cold Spring Harbor conference, and I hope if you're interested, please note the it's not yet a release, but it will come out very soon. So we meet again on a beautiful island and next to Kobe, if you like Kobe steak, and an island which is called Awaji. And with this, I would like to thank you for listening and take questions. Thank you so much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.